Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. Tales from the Road, Volume 4. It's difficult sometimes to get right into a company after finishing CDL training as a single driver. The reason is because all a company has to go on is your driving record when operating a car, not a semi. So some companies will require new recruits to first go out with a trainer who will evaluate your skills and readiness as a driver. Some companies prefer to have new drivers paired up with either another new driver or veteran driver as a team so that the vehicle is almost constantly rolling, along with the money rolling into their coffers. You've seen these trucks, Swift and Covenant being the most prevalent. I personally will never let another person drive my truck. I don't trust people. My trainer, Maurice, was a 23-year-old veteran driver who had his share of trainees over the years. He taught me everything I needed to make it in those first months as a newbie truck rustler. This included how to make sure you kept yourself fed and fueled. Maurice taught me that one of the best things you can buy as a long-haul trucker is a crock pot along with a power inverter to plug it in on the truck at the end of every driving shift. Before he bedded down for the day, he would observe and critique my driving. While he was doing this, he'd be sitting in the passenger seat, cutting board in his lap, cutting up ingredients to put in the crock pot for dinner later. I asked all the rookie questions, made all the rookie mistakes, but he said I was one of the best trainees he'd ever had. I, of course, beamed with pride, even though I suspected he said that to our recruits to bolster their confidence. He tempered his advice with stories and scenarios as to why this job was so tough. When, at 4 a.m. on a deserted city street, I cut a left turn a bit tight because there were no other cars in the area, Maurice scared the shit out of me by shouting. I hadn't even been aware he'd been watching. The fuck is wrong with you, son? What if there was a car there? You trying to kill a motherfucker? You trying to give my old black ass a fucking heart attack? I felt on the verge of tears as I continued driving the route. Maurice sat down to put on some socks and said, "Look, man, it wasn't really that big of a deal. But you gotta realize, you never want to get lazy out here. Because lazy people get fucked up and killed. I know I was a bit harsh, but you gotta up your game if you want to do this job for any length of time." I said I understood. At one point, I got curious and decided to ask him for examples of his worst trainees. He had examples of people with poor hygiene, abhorrent driving skills, and abysmal attention to detail, sloppy handwriting that made reading their logbooks almost impossible, which by DOT standards was unacceptable. Those are bad, but who was your absolute worst? Maurice took his time in answering, not because he had to think about it, but because, as he said, "I don't know if I should be telling you this because it was fairly recent, like two trainees before you recent. This motherfucker named Andy, he was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Always reading these true crime novels and textbooks on forensics. I mean, who giggles at shit like that? He talked to himself all the damn time, muttering shit under his breath, never yelled at anyone, but he'd get to his mumbling, his eyes would get kind of bulgy and this vein would stand out at his temples, like this motherfucker's head was gonna blow at any moment. Gave me the goddamn creeps. I had to have a talk with him when I heard him yanking his crank while I was driving. When I stopped the truck to open the curtain and explain that he needs to be considerate and save that shit for the truck stop showers, he just gave me this vacant grin. He'd covered himself, but not his laptop. It looked like he had pictures of women covered in fake blood and makeup, like gore porn or something fucking weirdo. He was a decent driver and always quiet, hardly ever asked questions. But if he was upset about something, you could tell. The hard part was trying to tell if it was you he was mad at. I yelled at him one time the way I yelled at you for that left turn the other day, son of a bitch just smiled real big and nodded at me. We were at Iowa 80, you know, biggest truck stop in the world. We were doing our 34-hour resit because we'd driven our asses off the previous week, and Andy up and disappears for about 24 of them. No contact or anything. I was close to calling the company and telling them he'd abandoned his job when here he comes, big as ever, strutting up to the rig with a shit-eating grin on his face. Where the fuck you been, Andy? I about had your shit sent home. I wanted to know. The smile dropped off his face and he got up right in mind. He was very precise with his words. Mind your fucking own, old man. After that, I had his ass transferred to another trainer to finish up. I suppose I could have filed a complaint, but I'm not sure I'd be sitting here right now if I had. Motherfucker gave me the heebie-jeebies after that. A week or so later, I'd finished my training and Maurice saw me off with a beer before I caught a ride home for a few days before going back on the road as a full-fledged employee driver. The company sent me a bus ticket down to the HQ terminal where I'd finish my processing paperwork and get assigned to a truck. Thankfully, they were paying me per diem because I sat at the terminal for 4 days before I got my assignment. I was assigned my dispatcher and she told me to meet my partner in the yard, truck number 19574. He'll be back in the yard at around noon. So I went and ate lunch after grabbing my gear from the hotel room that had me staying in. At about a quarter to noon, I made my way down to the truck yard and went looking for my new truck, my first truck. I was excited. As I walked down the line, reading off the truck numbers written above the front wheel well, I suddenly saw it, 19574. There was a tall, heavily muscled guy climbing down from the driver's seat. I walked up, announcing and introducing myself. Hey, and I gave my name, I'm your new co-driver. He turned around, his gray-green eyes taking me in, down to my outstretched hand. His face lit up into a strange sort of grin as he reached out. Hey, I'm Andy. Another story for the road. Aside from the fact that it was company policy, I made it a point to never, ever pick up a hitchhiker. I've seen too many horror, thriller, slasher movies to even have the desire. Even if the line in the movie Detroit Rock City reminds you that a lot of pornos also start out like that. Not to mention, I still have flashes of the Rutger Hauer movie The Hitcher from my childhood to remind me that it's just not a good idea. Under other circumstances, I have no compunctions or hesitation about being a good Samaritan. Most of the time, I ask my subjects if they want to use their real names when telling the stories. If they don't, I give them the opportunity to pick the name I'll use. If they don't pick a name, as you've seen, I'll pick a name that has something to do with their musical tastes. Such was the case with Lemmy. He wasn't your average Motorhead fan, seeing as he just turned 85 this year. He may be old, but I'll bet he can drive circles around you and parallel park a fully loaded rig better than you can a Mini Cooper. Lemmy doesn't hit the road with a rig anymore, but he does drive trailers around a warehouse near his home for a living. He says he doesn't need to, but he told me, it's when you stop moving that everything seizes up, and that's when the Reaper gets your ass. I agree, Lemmy. I agree. I was driving for a logging company from the late 1950s until the early 1980s. Anywhere from Oregon and Washington to Maine and Georgia and even Alaska for a few seasons. I've seen some crazy shit. From logging accidents that make even the most cast iron stomach sumbitch chuck his lunch to wrecks on the logging roads that neither Stephen Hawking nor Stephen King could explain, even if they put their melons together. Well, it was only a week or two after May 18, 1980. If y'all were alive back then, that's when Mount St. Helens erupted, blowing a huge chunk of the mountain sideways. I imagine you can find a video of it these days on that YouTubes or whatever. It's called Anyone Who Lived Within 100 Miles will recall how the ash fell like snow and covered every goddamn thing. We ended up covering our exhausts and intakes with old t-shirts to keep the ash from fucking up our engines. It took a short while for the state of Washington to clear the roads from the deep ash fall. At the time, I was driving a logger rig down the mountain in that area, or if I were lucky, I'd get to drive the rigs from the bottom of the logging camp to the mills we contracted for. There was speculation in the camps that the logging business in the area was going to grind to a halt. But when we heard that our company had won a contract bid to clear a good portion of the blowdown trees that the eruption had destroyed in the vicinity of the mountain, and that we were now clogging up Spirit Lake at its base, so that eased our fears of impending layoffs in the meantime. I was driving along US 20 from the base camp to one of the mills outside Tacoma when I came across a figure shrouded in a parka against the rain. They were trudging through 5 inches of mud on the roadside that the ash fall had turned into. I felt a bit bad for them, and since we were so close on the heels of the eruption, I still had the spirit of charity in my heart. I stopped to offer them a ride. "Where you headed, partner?" I shouted it because the rain was deafening on the roof of my truck. He looked up at me, and I recoiled a bit because this fellow looked like he'd been left in the oven a bit too long. He smiled and pulled a cardboard sign out of his parka. "Portland or bust," it read. "I'm headed to just outside Tacoma, so I can get you that far at least." The guy shot me a thumbs up and stowed a sign, climbing up into my passenger seat, being careful not to shake the rain off his parka onto my relatively dry interior. He lowered his hood, and by the God, he was an ugly son of a bitch. Every bit of skin I could see looked like he'd been charbroiled. He even smelled a bit sulfurous and burnt. "For fuck's sake, man, what the hell happened to you?" He held up a finger, as if to say 1 second, and dug around his pockets. Producing a stubby pencil and a small notebook, he scribbled, "Don't know. Woke up like this. Sorry, can't talk." I looked at him a little bit. "What do you mean you woke up like that?" He bent to his tablet again. "Woke up in the woods by the mountain." He pointed off in the direction of Mount St. Helens. "You get right the fuck on out of here. You got caught in the eruption? How in the name of Satan's gnarly nutsack are you alive?" He shrugged and laughed a little. Sounded like a pair of pumice stones rubbing together in a sandpaper bag. "Did you just get out of the hospital or something?" He frowned a little and shook his head. "Well, cut my nuts and call me Susan. Actually, name's Lemmy. What do you go by, son?" The guy kind of hung his head and shook it, writing, "Don't know. I don't remember anything except I need to go to Portland. Now, I'm a fairly skeptical person, and I do tend to call people out when they're feeding me a line of bullshit, but this guy looked like he didn't have a bone of deceit in him. Well, if that doesn't rattle the bishop's tits, I don't know what I'll do if I didn't remember my name. I take that back. I've been that drunk before." The sound of more rocks tumbling together told me he was laughing. "Shit. I'll call you Quasimodo. You're ugly enough to pull it off. Just ain't got the hump." He considered it and shrugged, giving me a thumbs up. I don't know what else to say at the moment, so I clapped my trap and drove for a little bit before a question occurred to me. "What do you think you were doing in that area? And what do you think is waiting for you in Portland?" He looked like he was thinking real hard, he wrote. "I woke up just on the far side of the lake that the mountain sits on." He was struggling for the name. I helped. "Spirit Lake? You're kidding. You were that close?" He nodded. "That's where I woke up anyway," said the pad. He wrote a long time. "As far as Tacoma, I have no idea. Home? Work? Family? I'm hoping it's at least one of those things." I agreed that that would bode well for his situation. He gave me a sheepish look and then wrote, "I haven't eaten anything substantial since I woke up. Do you mind if we stop somewhere to eat?" I must have looked at him funny because his eyes got a worried look, and he quickly scribbled, "I have money." I said it was no problem, and we stopped off at the next exit that I had a fast food joint. As we took off after the food stop, he seemed to doze off a bit, leaning against the passenger door. That was all right with me, and I just hammered down as much as the road conditions would let me. I heard a growling noise all of a sudden. My eyes shot over to Quasimodo. He was out like a light. The sound was deep and grating. Imagine what the tectonic plates on a fault line might sound like 1,000 feet down if you could get a mic down there without it melting. Then he started saying something in his sleep. At least, I think he was talking, though it didn't sound like any language I knew. It sounded like a mix of German, Hungarian, and someone rubbing two big rocks together. I didn't like it at all, especially when a bit of smoke or steam, whatever it was, drifted from between his lips. "Hey, Quasimodo, wake up!" He jerked awake with a start, his eyes meeting mine with a trace of concern as he scrambled for his notepad. "What's wrong?" he wrote in all capitals. "I don't know if you were snoring or talking in your sleep, but you just had some bizarre-ass sounds coming out of your face hole. I thought you couldn't speak." He looked puzzled and wrote, "I can't. Well, at least not without sounding like I drank acid or something." He opened his mouth, and a noise like a broken conveyor belt issued from his throat. I held up my hand. "Gotcha, gotcha. Just don't do that again." He gave me a thumbs up. As we pulled into Tacoma, he slipped a thank you note wrapped into a $20 bill to the visor above his head. I tried to tell him it wasn't necessary and reached out to grab his shoulder as he turned to get out of the truck. The second I touched him, there was a sizzling sound, and I drew my hand back and watched as a red welt rose in my palm. I looked at Quasimodo again, saw steam rise off his shoulders as the rain hit him. His eyes almost looked like they were a luminescent red, just in the whites, though. He smiled and chuckled. That sound like breaking rocks again, and waved goodbye as he turned and walked away through the truck stop parking area. That was my last trip as a log runner, and it was the last time I ever picked up a hitchhiker. You can bet your sweet ass on that. And another story for the road. "You ain't heard shit yet, son," Lemmy rubbed absentmindedly at the smooth skin of his burn-scarred palm. Truckers that drive for logging companies have some of the most hazardous work in the world, but the ones that last also happen to be some of the best, most experienced drivers. Lemmy points to a series of plaques on his garage wall, the newest congratulating him on over 6 million safe miles, signed and sealed by the current director of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Back in the 60s, we had a lot less regulations as far as safety and the like, all across the board. Accidents were common, and the lack of that regulation I just mentioned meant that a lot wasn't reported. Now, we were a labor union back in the day. To drive for the logging companies, you had to be. We got paid well for the shit we put up with. We also got paid well to keep our mouths shut when weird shit went down. There was one incident that a lot of guys said might have been tied to the disturbance of what you kids these days might refer to as an indigenous people's internment habitat. But we call them Indian burial grounds then. Now, I'm not saying we did run into one of them, but it might have, could have happened. And if you press me, I'll ollie north the shit out of your questions. I assure you, I did not press him for information. So, this was about the fall of 66, and we were hauling trucks from northern Maine to the various mills, some of which were cleared down near the big cities. During the winters, we took them as far as the railhead and had them loaded on a train and run it down that way. One thing Ewens might not be aware of was that at this time, there was a labor shortage up in the Northwoods area of Maine, and we couldn't get enough red-blooded American boys to do the work. So the Department of Labor made a deal with those Canuck motherfuckers up north to ship labor from Canada. I'll work with blacks and Mexicans, or even Asian folks, before I work with another goddamn Canuck bastard. These sons of Quebecois, moose-fucking, back-alley whores who spoke more fucking French than anything else, shitting all over this country, even though we bailed out their forebears in World War II. I wouldn't piss on their burning corpses to put out a fire. Hell, I probably lit the fucking match. Tell us how you really feel, Lemmy. Shit. Now, I digress. I haven't had the chance to deal with the folks of this generation from up there. But damn, I hate those old Canuck bastards. One of those sons of bitches always used to swear at me, pointing and saying shit like, Christ de Calice de Sacrament de Tabernacle de Sti de Cibrois. I only know it because he left it in a note under my windshield one day. I don't know what the hell it means, but you can tell when someone is cussing you, no matter what language they speak. Anyhow, there was all these Canadians crawling through the Maine Northwoods, and most of them I'll give credit to for being hard workers, especially in the winter. Man, those fuckers love the cold. It also made the logging easier once the lakes froze up, and we could cut a few miles off the haul by just driving across them. There were some mishaps, but the company went for profit over safety every time, so that didn't matter much. The weird shit started one frosty winter day. He was a sod jockey named Henry, pronounced Henri. He was taking on some prime old growth, a tree about 70 feet tall and big around enough that it warranted the use of the old Swedish fiddle. You know them 12-foot-long saw blades with a handle on each end you see in the old cartoons? Well, Henri was working this tree with one of the American guys. His name escapes me. They're almost to the back cut, a wedge cut out of the tree that determines the direction it will fall. And you hear the really loud crack. Well, Henri, he grabs his head, drops to his knees yelling, Tabernak! As he's on his knees. That tree, it starts sliding sideways on its stump. Not towards the back cut, not the opposite direction, but sideways. I wouldn't have believed a fucking word of it from anyone else had I not seen it with my own peepers. The other guy, well, he was lucky and smart. He runs like he's got Satan himself on his heels. But Henry, he stuck fast, clawing at his chest now as this massive tree seems to float over his head until it clears the stump, and then there was this thwomp sound, like someone opened up a vacuum in the middle of the forest, and the tree just drops straight down, and Henry gets fucking pulped by the 1,200 pounds of tree that just dropped out of the sky on his terrified, upturned face. Now, you're going to ask, why didn't nobody rush in and try and save Henry? Well, shit, I don't fucking know. It was like watching a train wreck. I was about 200 feet away and my feet were glued to the dirt. The tree just stood there. No common decency to fall or nothing. Nobody wanted to go near it. We eventually got it pushed over after cutting a few wedges out of the bottom. It fell with more of a satisfied sigh than a mighty crash. And that's when we finally got a look at what was left of Henry. If there hadn't been about 40 men that had witnessed this freak of nature, we wouldn't have been able to identify the remains as human. We could smell burnt sage, and there seemed to be a word seared into the bottom of the tree once we rolled it off the mush. Repoke. There was one guy on the crew that freaked the fuck out and started talking a language that nobody else even came close to knowing. He seemed to be in shock, and the crew boss yelled at me, Lemmy, take Edward back to base camp and have his talk to the doc. I led Edward, he was an Indian fella, to my rig and got him in the passenger side. He seemed to calm down as we got further away from the accident scene. Edward, what's that gibberish you're spouting? He looked at me then and he laughed a little and said, you call it gibberish. I call it my mother tongue, white man. Oh, well, excuse me, Tonto. I don't speak your mother tongue. So if you'd be so kind as explain to me what exactly the fuck freaked you out back there, aside from watching a guy get turned to Canadian puree. Edward got very serious and said, that man angered the forest. It meted out its justice. Now, I know them natives are all lovey-dovey with the land and all, but how in the unholy fuck do you anger a forest, Edward? Edward looked at me and said, he must have disturbed the old ones that still inhabit the area. Or perhaps he violated a grave. He's been labeled by the forest as a devil. At least, that's what the tree told us. Repoke is an old Algonquin word, meaning literally, devil. I wasn't too sure about this because I was pretty skeptical back in those days. Edward, tell you what, you keep that native mumbo-jumbo to yourself. We don't need a bunch of Catholic Canadians getting all superstitious, manpower is in short supply, as it is without them beating feet in a mass exodus across the border. Edward nodded his agreement, but cautioned. If Henry was not the only perpetrator, we can expect more death. He wasn't wrong. The next day, we were in a convoy, coming down out of the higher elevations, when the truck in front of me lost its brakes and sped into a low culvert. The truck came to sudden stop against the embankment on the other side, which would have been fine except for the large log that came loose and punched through the driver's side of the truck like a thumbtack through paper. The hips and legs stayed in the driver's seat, while everything else above the waist was mashed through the windshield and was found still stuck to the log 50 feet from the truck. The first guy on the scene said when he wrenched open the driver's door to check on the driver, there were the legs, the right foot still dancing around and hitting the brake pedal. The left was still tapping out a beat to go along with the music on the AM radio. We got the mangled body of the driver peeled off the log. What was left of his face was frozen in an expression that mingled surprise and terror. We smelt that burnt sage again, and on the log beneath the body was the word repoke branded into the wood. I got out of there and got to the camp where Edward was waiting for me in the dining hall. I hear the driver was a friend of Henry, he said. I think the time to be silent has passed. We must find out if there will be more. I agreed. Edward and I went to the foreman in charge of the Canadian workers and asked who Henry and the driver were known to hang around. One happened to be my buddy, constantly cussed me. I was hard-pressed to give two farmyard fresh fucks if anything happened to that waste of biomass. I said so to Edward and was rewarded with a sidelong glance followed by a matronly tut-tut. Having been properly scolded by Mother Edward, we found the aforementioned bane of my existence outside his cabin, where I received the customary sneer of derision and greeting. Lemmy, to what do I owe the displeasure of your dog-fucking face in my presence? I held my tongue and let Edward do the talking. We have come to ask some questions about your deceased friends. We need to know if you may be in danger as well. Did you and your friends desecrate an Indian burial site or anything of that nature? The tall, gangly bastard's eyes widened a little bit, but he hid his surprise quickly with an arrogant sneer. Who the fuck are you, Chief Sitting Bull? I do not need to answer your questions. Go back to fucking Lemmy in your cabin and leave us be. Edward looked like he was going to speak again, but I just shook my head and said, Look, Jacques, personally, I could give a wet fart in a windstorm's amount of shits as to whether or not whatever is going on or whoever is going around killing you ass clowns for upsetting some spirit of the forest and branding you devils. Edward here, on the other hand, has it on his conscience as an Indian to try and save your asses no matter how bad you might have fucked up or offended his ancestors. If you all did something, fess up now so he can help you. Otherwise, you can go fuck yourselves, in my opinion. Jacques seemed to weigh his options, and it was the first time he'd shut his mouth for more than 30 seconds since I met him. I don't think he expected me to be nice as I was being. Henry, he found a clearing with these few shallow depressions festooned with feathers and bones and jars and such. He told us about his find, and there were four of us, went to the clearing and we took some things. I took a stone dagger. Henry took some old rattler-like thing. Lawrence, the driver, he took a headdress and Lucian. He pointed to his buddy about 100 feet away, smoking a cigarette. He took a pipe. That's all, I swear. We need to replace those things and cleanse the way for the spirits to rest again, Edward said urgently. Please gather them, and Lucian, we must hurry. Jacques hollered for Lucian to shag ass and get the pipe and meet us at the chow hall in 5 minutes. He said he'd collected the things the others had taken after they died, so we were all set and ready to go when we heard a scream from a few cabins down. Lucian, pipe in hand, had been making his way to the chow hall when a branch from far above in the trees had fallen and driven itself through his right shoulder, exited around his asshole, and impaled itself to the ground. Lucian was stuck there, 1 foot paused midway through stride, like a fucking butterfly on a specimen display. He was still alive and screaming. He cried for Jacques. He cried for his mama, but most of all he cried for the good Lord Almighty to deliver him from this living hell. As we tried to comfort him, we smelled again the burned sage, and the word repoke emblazoned itself across the part of the branch still above his now lolling head. Lucian used the last of his strength to hold out the hand holding the pipe to Edward. Je suis vraiment désolé. I'm so sorry, Jacques translated. They were his last words. Filled with urgency now, Jacques ran, begging us to follow. We followed him through the woods as it got darker, 5, maybe 6 miles from the camp, until we came to a clearing where the wind held at our intrusion. Edward started a chant in his language, holding the pilfered objects over his head. He walked into the clearing. Jacques and I started to follow, but Edward only shook his head. He continued his chant around the clearing and stopped at one of the depressions and laid one of the objects on it. It sunk into the ground with a whisper. He continued this until at last he laid the dagger Jacques had taken on one last grave. It just sat there. Edward renewed his chant louder and faster this time, a bit of a tremor in his voice. Why won't fucking go back in? I heard Jacques whisper, fear in his voice. The wind picked up then and Edward stopped chanting, his head tilted, listening. I'm so sorry, Jacques. The forest says no. The forest dragged Jacques, screaming in his own mother tongue, into the clearing. The smell of burnt sage filled the air as the word repoke seared its way across his chest. The forest tore him apart with roots, and the earth devoured his flesh until there was nothing left. At last, the wind whispered, and the dagger sank back into the earth. Now, I ain't gonna say the Canuck bastard didn't deserve exactly what he got, but goddamn if I didn't have a deep respect for our Indian friends after that, and I'd lecture the new guys to keep their hands to themselves from then on. Edward and I still keep in touch from time to time, and he sends me some venison every winter. Moral of the story, I guess, is don't fucking take what ain't yours, especially if it belongs to the forest.